Good morning, Your Honor. Stacey Anderson on behalf of the appellant, Timothy Harrison.
Let's let everyone get settled.
I apologize, Your Honor. Morning, Your Honor. Again, Stacey Anderson on behalf of the appellant, Timothy Harrison. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The issue I'd like to focus on this morning is this court's jurisdiction to hear this interlocutory appeal. Your Honors, I am not standing before this court asking the court to reverse the district court on a question of whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact in this case. I'm before the court asking that this court find the district court erred in denying Officer Harrison's summary judgment motion based on the fact that Officer Harrison failed to negate the allegation of force in his summary judgment submissions. Clearly,
I want to be clear. The judge didn't deny the defense. He simply said there were material facts such that summary judgment on the defense was inappropriate at this time. Is that not correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think the result is the same, though, because...
Well, but the judge left open that after he had heard further facts, he may well...
Which leads me to be utterly mystified as to why you're appealing.
Well, Your Honor, I think regardless of what Officer Harrison said regarding his use of force, in ruling on the summary judgment motion, the district court was constrained to accept Mr. Watt's properly supported allegations of force. Officer Harrison's silence on this issue or his evidence that he denied the allegation of force should not change the summary judgment analysis. The district court had to accept Mr. Watt's properly supported allegations of force in ruling on the summary judgment motion. So, again, Officer Harrison's silence should not have been a basis for denying the motion for summary judgment. In addition, based on the record that was before the court, the district court was had well within its grasp and ability to grant the summary judgment motion on the evidence when viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Watts. In this case in particular, Mr. Watts failed to present any evidence whatsoever establishing the unreasonableness of the use of force in this case. In addition to that, Officer Harrison did present evidence establishing the reasonableness of the force in this case. Officer Harrison presented Mr. Watts' guilty plea hearing testimony in which Mr. Watts admitted that he struggled with Officer Harrison at the time of the arrest, and he reached for his guns.
Was that actually presented before the district judge?
Yes, Your Honor. It was an exhibit to our summary judgment motion.
I want to just follow up on my point and question here. It's interesting when you read the plea transcript to note that after the prosecutor made that long statement and was asked if he agreed, Mr. Watts said yes. And then the judge proceeded to say to Mr. Watts, here's what the government would have to prove if you went to trial. And the judge never referred to the government having the burden to show that Mr. Watts reached for the gun.
That is correct, Your Honor. I concede that. But the court did make the point that in order for the government to prove its case, that the government would have to prove a traditional assault on the officer. And again, Mr. Watts did admit under oath that he reached for that gun, and that would have been the government's evidence.
When did he admit that?
At the guilty plea hearing, in response.
But I just went through this with you. In other words, the prosecutor says, here's what proof we would offer.
Correct.
All right. And then the judge says, do you understand you're giving up your right to trial? Here's what the government would have to prove if you went to trial. Judge never mentions the gun.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I don't think that changes the fact that Mr.
Right.
Watts did.
I want to be clear about that.
Okay. I appreciate that, Your Honor. But again, I don't think it changes the fact that when Mr. Watts was asked whether that statement of facts was true, he said under oath that was a true statement of facts. Mm-hmm. And again, at page 108 of the appendix, in fact, the judge actually forgot to swear Mr. Watts when he initially asked him that question, and again asked him if he agreed with Ms. Serafan's, who was the prosecutor's, proffer He swore him at that point and again asked, do you agree with that proffer? And he did say he agreed with that proffer. So based on the evidence that's in the record before the district court, it is the government's position that the district court could have and should have granted Officer Harrison's motion for summary judgment on qualified immunity because as a matter
of... Do you think it's clear that, I guess this is following up on Judge Silberman's question, do you think it's clear that the district court judge actually ruled on qualified immunity?
I think he denied the motion at a stage when he could have granted it. So yes, at that point, again, the record was complete in terms of discovery. There was no indication, again, if Officer Harrison presented additional evidence on that particular issue of force, that the district court's analysis would have been any different in this case. He would have had to accept Mr. Watts' properly supported allegation of force. So giving Officer Harrison an opportunity to present evidence on this point, again, would not have changed the district court's analysis in this case. So I do think that because the record was complete.
I take that point, but it's just not clear from the district court's opinion necessarily that there was actually a specific ruling on qualified immunity.
I think it's couched in terms of I can't grant the motion because there's this genuine issue of fact, which is tantamount, I think, generally to how a denial of qualified immunity. Your Honor, it's not like Johnson because I'm not asking the court to find that the district court erroneously found conflicting facts in dispute. In fact, in this case,
the Supreme Court said that the appellate court didn't have jurisdiction where the district court denied a motion for summary judgment based on qualified immunity because the district court concluded there were material.
I think that's an incorrect statement of the holding in Johnson. What the court held in Johnson, I believe, and I think subsequent decisions will bear this out, is that the party appealing cannot challenge the genuineness of the dispute. The Supreme Court has since said repeatedly there can be genuine disputes of material fact in the record, and that can be the basis of the district court's decision to deny qualified immunity. But if the court, in conducting de novo review on the legal question of whether the officer is entitled to qualified immunity as a matter of law, the court reviews the record in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, usually the plaintiff, disregards the conflicts and looks at that evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party and makes the legal determination. So the fact that there are disputed facts in the record, material, if the officer still wins, even accepting the plaintiff's version of events, regardless of whether they're disputed, the officer is entitled to qualified immunity as a matter of law.
That's again, not real clear from Johnson, but it is clear from I grant you later cases
Saucier,
clarified
certainly.
Johnson's potential confusion.
Yes, and I again, and mentioning Saucier, Johnson was pre-Saucier, so it really didn't.
Pre-Barons.
Right, exactly. Yes, so I do think this case is very, very different than Johnson.
Without the plea colloquy, would qualified immunity be appropriate at this stage?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so because. Mr. Watts' submissions, standing alone, are insufficient to establish the elements of his claim. If I could give the court an example, if a defendant said, or a plaintiff says, the officer shot me, and the officer says in response in an affidavit, competent summary judgment evidence, yes, I shot you, but when I shot you, you were standing with a knife to a woman's neck, and you were threatening to kill her. Now, there's two ways to look at that case. You can look solely at the plaintiff's evidence. His evidence is the officer shot me. If he got up on the stand and that's the case he presented, the government would be entitled to a directed verdict at the summary judgment stage. If that's the only evidence the plaintiff has, the government's entitled to summary judgment. There's been no showing that the use of force under those circumstances is excessive. The other way of looking at it is to look at the entire record. The uncontroverted evidence from the police officer regarding the woman, the threat, and the knife, plus the shooting, and analyze it that way. In this case, what we have in Mr. Watts' submissions is simply the officer used a chokehold. He struck me several times in the face. No context, no facts that would show that the officer's use of force at that point in time was unreasonable.
I think he'd have a tough case without the guilty plea.
It would certainly be more difficult. I have a tougher case. But again, the question under Celotex.
Not just tougher, tough.
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't think that there is any evidence that shows that the officer's actions were unreasonable in Mr. Watts' submissions. He certainly alleges force in his complaint, but out of context and without a showing that force was unreasonable under the circumstances, Mr. Watts cannot prevail on his claim, and the government is entitled to summary judgment. If I could reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Goldblatt. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and I was appointed as an amicus in this case. With the Court's permission, argument today will be presented by Colin D. Forbes, a third-year law student at Georgetown who will be appearing in conformity with the rules of the Court.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Officer Harrison's appeal from the District Court's denial of qualified immunity must fail for two reasons. First, all of Officer Harrison's arguments hinge upon this Court's acceptance of material facts that are in dispute. Under the Supreme Court's case in Johnson v. Jones.
Well, don't you have to take the guilty plea colloquy?
No, Your Honor. We don't have to take the guilty plea colloquy because the record facts must be taken in the light most favorable to Mr. Watts, and there is record evidence that is in conflict.
He can't dispute the guilty plea colloquy, can he?
He can dispute certain facts that are in the guilty plea colloquy, yes, Your Honor, because the issue of judicial estoppel upon which Officer Harrison relies is in and of itself at bottom a dispute about facts, which is what the Johnson case says is unappealable. But even if the guilty plea colloquy is accepted, Your Honor, that ultimately does not make this case appealable, nor does it mean that Officer Harrison wins on the merits, because the guilty plea colloquy does not resolve anything about the temporal sequence of events. Even accepting the facts in the plea colloquy, the record merely discloses that there was a struggle between Mr. Watts and Officer Harrison, and that at some point Mr. Watts's hand was on Officer Harrison's gun. However, it does not establish and Officer Harrison's argument assumes that the force was used in response to the struggle by Mr. Watts and in response to the effort to reach for the gun. Officer Harrison only argues that it
was... Well, that's after running away, running down the stairs, throwing furniture in front of the officer, refusing to surrender when surrounded, resisting, and then getting into some kind of struggle and reaching for the officer's gun while other people were around who could have been hurt or killed.
Indeed, Your Honor, and it is not our position.
And that's all in the plea colloquy.
Yes, Your Honor, it is in the plea colloquy, and in fact, a significant part of that context is also in Mr. Watts's evidence, where he says that he ran into the basement and proceeded to elude Officer Harrison. There's no question that some level of force was appropriate to apprehend Mr. Watts in this case. The problem is that the record reveals at 22 that a chokehold was employed, and the record also reveals in the hospital records that Mr. Watts was slammed down on the floor and kicked on the head while he was being arrested. And first, taking the record evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Watts, to the extent that there was a struggle, this force occurred before the struggle. And
you can't say to the extent there was a struggle if you're accepting the plea colloquy, but go ahead.
Accepting the plea colloquy and to the extent that there was a struggle and an attempt to reach for the gun, accepting the record facts in the light most favorable to Watts, that occurred after Officer Harrison first cornered him, punched him in the face, knocked him on the ground, kicked him on the head, and then placed him in a chokehold. And under those circumstances, under cases such as DeGraff, the subsequent struggle simply does not make the force that was initially used reasonable. And Officer Harrison never...
What about the medical records? I mean, here's my problem, to put it straight. If you take the guilty plea colloquy combined with the medical records, it's hard to come up with a scenario where there's unreasonable force used. Maybe not impossible, but you know, the guilty plea colloquy does say struggled, resisted arrest, grabbed the officer's gun, and the medical records show some bruising on the face, right?
Well, the medical
records, which is part of the struggle. doesn't, the medical records, I guess what I'm getting at, don't really show by their nature unreasonable force in response to someone who's resisted arrest and tried to grab an officer's gun, at least as I read them.
Well, I think the key part of that, Your Honor, is the in response part. And assuming that that this was not responsive use of force, this in fact looks a lot like a beating that was not responsive to any particular threat.
Yeah, and I parsed the plea colloquy to see, because your temporal sequence point is a good one, and I want to examine that. On A101 in the plea colloquy, it says, Officer Harrison, this is after the chase, right? So they run into the cafeteria and mailroom area. Several employees are there. And I'll quote, Officer Harrison attempted unsuccessfully to try to detain and handcuff defendant who resisted arrest and struggled with Officer Harrison. Officer Harrison required the assistance of at least two and as many as three or four civilians who were working within the gas company to detain and subdue the defendant. As Officer Harrison did not have handcuffs on him, he required the assistance of an officer who finally arrived and he was able to handcuff the defendant. In the course of the struggle, two civilians observed defendant Watts attempting to remove Officer Harrison's handgun, which was in a holster at his hip. I don't know, end quote, I don't know where out of that you can get your temporal sequencing argument that you have in your brief.
The temporal sequence argument,
in other words, that he was being beaten before he resisted.
The portion of the record that you quote, Judge Kavanaugh, does not show the sequence of events that I am saying is possible. The record at pages 76 and 77 states, plaintiff proceeded to elude apprehension and was cornered in the basement area of 1100 New York Avenue, and defendant Harrison struck the plaintiff to the face and head and commenced to chokehold the plaintiff until unconsciousness. The record facts there do not state that before he was struck in the face and choked into unconsciousness, that he struggled, and it's reasonable to infer that that the blows and that the chokehold occurred immediately upon being cornered.
You think he can assert facts here? I guess this goes back to the estoppel point. He can assert facts here that are inconsistent with what he agreed to in the guilty plea colloquy.
Well, Your Honor, assuming that estoppel is an appealable issue, it's just not inconsistent with the plea colloquy. The plea colloquy simply establishes that there was a struggle. It doesn't say when it happened, and therefore, no matter.
I'd be surprised if the judge who heard that guilty plea would agree that, oh, by the way, the defendant was beaten up before he resisted, because the district, the sentencing judge then goes on to say, with regard in describing what would need to be proved, this is on A104, with regard to the assault, they'd have to prove that you did a classical assault, which is to say an attempt to injure this police officer or that you resisted or impeded his efforts to stop you and make a seizure of your person. They'd have to prove that you did that on purpose, and they'd have to prove, if you claimed self-defense, they'd have to prove that the officer was not using excessive force.
Well, he did not claim self-defense, and the APO statute is
the temporal sequencing you're describing is self-defense.
Well, Your Honor, it's not entirely clear why he pleaded guilty.
The temporal sequencing you're describing is that the officer went down into the cafeteria area and started beating him up, and then he resisted and tried to grab the officer's gun. I'm saying that seems inconsistent with the guilty plea colloquy and very inconsistent with what the sentencing judge specifically told the defendant he could try to prove, or what the government would have to prove if he were tried.
Well, the sentencing judge also stated that resisting and interfering with an officer was sufficient under the APO statute for a guilty plea. And the facts as they were recited by Ms. Serafan, as I said earlier, simply don't resolve the exact order in which it happened. And it's not inconsistent with the idea that Mr. Watts did, in fact, resist and struggle with Officer Harrison, but that Officer Harrison also used excessive force first. And indeed, the record, I think it's important to point out, does not even show that Officer Harrison was aware that Mr. Watts was reaching for his gun. The record states that Larry Rollins, an employee of Washington Gas, saw Mr. Watts reach for the gun and removed his hand. And so it doesn't support the notion that the force used, the chokehold and the kick to the head, that these were responses to Mr. Watts's threat. And yet, Officer Harrison's argument depends upon, and this also goes to the appealability, Your Honor, Officer Harrison's argument depends upon this court resolving that disputed issue of fact in his favor. And that's precisely what Johnson says that Officer Harrison cannot do. And moreover, Officer Harrison's arguments about context are at bottom evidentiary sufficiency arguments.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. Without the guilty plea colloquy, I think you'd have a, you'd prevail easily. But I'm concerned about someone going into a guilty plea colloquy and saying one thing and saying something quite a bit different in a civil suit right afterwards. And that concerns me.
Well, Your Honor, I see that I'm running out of time, but if I may address that point quickly. Mm-hmm.
What did the district judge say about the guilty plea colloquy?
The district judge stated that there is no dispute that Harrison employed some force in order to subdue the plaintiff, who admitted to struggling with Harrison and to resisting arrest.
Did he not refer specifically to the guilty plea colloquy?
Well, he referred to Officer Harrison's argument.
No, I'm asking whether he referred to the guilty plea colloquy.
He stated that Officer Harrison relied on the guilty plea colloquy. Yes, Your Honor. But ultimately, for the reasons that I've stated, the guilty plea colloquy simply doesn't resolve the temporal sequence of events. It does not make this case appealable. And alternatively, Mr. Watts should prevail on the merits. And if there are no further questions.
Did you want to respond to Judge Kavanaugh's question?
I apologize, Your Honor.
No need to apologize.
It was more a comment, anyway.
Ultimately, as I said earlier, judicial estoppel is at bottom a dispute about facts, and it's not proper on appeal. But to the extent that it is an appealable issue, what is required to show is not mere inconsistency, but bad faith. And given the expansiveness of the recitation of facts, and given that that Mr. Watts did not disagree with most of them, and indeed that not all of those facts were required in order to plead guilty to APO, while inconsistency may or may not be shown, bad faith is not shown.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Forbes, for assisting the court.
Yeah. I just had two brief points, Your Honors. First of all, to the extent that there's a gap in the evidence, that only operates to Officer Harrison's advantage in this case. Again, Mr. Watts is the party who has the burden of proving that there is that was an unreasonable use of force. To the extent there's no evidence in the record that establishes that Officer Harrison struck Mr. Watts before the struggle or after he was subdued, Mr. Watts' claim has to fail. No unreasonable use of force.
Why is that?
Again, as he's—
Summary judgment?
On summary judgment, if there's no evidence in the record that the use of force was unreasonable, and in these circumstances, I think the only two situations—
I thought you were saying if there's no evidence in the record about the sequencing, be taken in the officer's favor. I'm not sure that's correct.
I believe it is, Your Honor, for the reason that, again, Mr. Watts has the burden of proving the unreasonableness of the force. If he fails to establish the sequence of events, a sequence of events such that the court can conclude the force was unreasonable, then his claim fails. I agree with Your Honor's reading of page 101 of the appendix and the sequence that was set out in the plea colloquy.
Counsel, I'm a little mystified. Put aside the question whether you're entitled to prevail or not. It would have been rather easy for you to satisfy the district judge, apparently. Why was it necessary to appeal in this case?
Because, again, Your Honor, having done that would not have changed anything. The district court had everything before it needed to determine whether or not Officer Harrison—
You didn't answer my question.
Why didn't we?
You could easily satisfy him on the factual issues. I'm sort of mystified as to why you pulled the trigger on appeal.
I was not privy to that decision, Your Honor, so I don't know that I have a concrete reason. I think, obviously, in representing a police officer, To the extent you can avoid presenting evidence on the force, I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
You had people you could provide evidence that were, or you had observers.
We presented the plea colloquy, Your Honor, I think.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And then the other point I wanted to make, Your Honors, is that Johnson recognizes in circumstances where the district court fails to set forth its factual facts that it finds adequately supported by the record, that this court does undertake a de novo review. And in doing that, this court does not disregard well-settled principles governing summary judgment practice, which requires that evidence be in the record to support allegations, not simply allegations in the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Take the case under.